Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you listening. This morning, we want to talk about yesterday's election and what it might mean for American politics. We also want to take a look at some of the challenges that the next president will face. And for the program today, we've made some changes in our usual format. We will have four guests instead of the customary two. Each of them will be spending half an hour with us. And also joining me this morning to share in the hosting duties is Celeste Quinn. She's
good
the
morning.
Host of the Afternoon Magazine. Really good to have you here with me. As always, we want to invite callers. Now, the thing is that people can really help us this morning by keeping their comments brief, but questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the first hour, what we want to try to do is to take a look at national politics, and we'll be doing that in the second half. But we thought that we would start off closer to home and talk about Illinois politics.
We begin this morning by taking a look at what happened in Illinois and what lies ahead for state politics. Our first guest this morning is Bethany Yeager, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Issues magazine. Illinois Issues is a monthly publication distributed statewide and based at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Our guest, Bethany Yeager, also writes a blog called Illinois Issues Blog. Bethany Yeager, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Did Barack Obama help Democrats expand their majorities in the General Assembly, and will that affect relations between the legislature and the governor?
It absolutely affected the Democrats. There was a tidal wave, and two particular seats in the Chicago suburbs were relented from Republicans to Democrats, and that's partially because the Obama factor, where a record number of Democrats went out to vote, and they went to vote for Barack Obama, and they ended up voting Democratic all the way down the ticket. So that helped in particularly two areas of the Chicago suburbs. And regarding the relations with the governor, the Senate already has a supermajority. That's the title used to describe the number of votes needed to approve major spending or borrowing or anything that needs an extra majority of votes. The Senate has had that for 2 years, but with Senate President Emil Jones Jr. and a very divisive caucus, they haven't been able to use it. And now Senate President Emil Jones is retiring, and that's more of a factor than the Obama factor with Governor Rod Blagojevich. With the new Senate president, the atmosphere could really change in the Capitol, and things could really change with how the legislature interacts with the governor.
Did we see any indication in the campaign and now with the election about who might be the next majority leader in the state Senate?
Oh, absolutely. And to tell you the truth, money is the first place to find out who has the most potential. Right now, there are two in particular leaders. One is John Cullerton from Chicago. He's donated a lot of money. He's actually created a new campaign fund to collect money and then dole it out to candidates of the Democratic Party just to say, hey, I can support the Democratic caucus and I can replace Jones. You can feel comfortable with me as your leader. And the other person that has come out on top in terms of fundraising and supporting candidates is James Claiborne. And he's from Belleville in southern Illinois. And so he actually brings a new dynamic, but he also brings a lot of money. So those two in particular are sticking out. But there are actually a handful of others who might be a little more, may have a few more independent streaks, who are willing to consider themselves compromise candidates if the caucus can't find who to vote for or who to elect their new leader.
Okay. Bethany Yeager, our first guest this morning here on Focus 580. And we have a caller now who would like to join us on line one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, good. Yeah, we can hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm concerned about what happened in our county government yesterday during the election. I understood that the students in the dorms were kept from voting by a rule that was passed by a ruling that was passed by the county clerk, Mark Sheldon, and that he said that leases that were signed for a university dorm with the state of Illinois was not considered correct identification. And I am wondering if that is grounds for malfeasance in office, and whether the state of Illinois and maybe even the local state's attorney might prosecute Mark Sheldon for keeping the dormitory students from voting. I know traditionally he's not been interested in having student voters because they tend, according to him, to be Democratic and Democratic Party voters, and he is definitely a very big Republican partisan in Champaign County. Anyway, I was pretty appalled by the whole thing.
I think we've got your point, and I'm going to stop here now and continue on. I think that in the coming days and weeks, we're going to probably take a number of looks at what happened and who voted and were there any hang-ups and that kind of thing. And I think that that might be something that we could keep in mind.
I'm sure. Again, I want to thank the caller for the comment, not saying that that's not something important. I think that's not something that we can particularly deal with here this morning on this show and with this particular guest, unless, Bethany, you want to comment on that.
No,
particularly.
Thank you. I'd be happy to look into it, but right now I don't have an immediate reaction.
Well, let me just very quickly tell people who are listening that this is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Celeste Quinn is here with me sharing the duties, and we wanted to take this first opportunity to talk about some of the issues arising out of yesterday's election. And, of course, as always, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're trying to be on a tight schedule this morning because we're splitting up the hours, and Bethany will only be with us till about 10:30. So particularly, we'd be interested in this segment, questions that have to do with state Illinois, state politics, perhaps what's going to happen in the legislature and so forth.
Bethany Yeager is State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Issues Magazine. Well, now, Bethany, it's up to the governor to name a successor for Senator, now President-elect, Obama. Who's in the running, and when might we see that announcement?
Well, actually, you might see it this afternoon at
1:30
p.m. in Chicago.
Okay.
And so I don't really want to hazard a guess, to tell you the truth. There are so many out there. Maybe it's been leaked by now. I haven't heard confirmation. But I think you don't have to wait too long. 1:30 is supposed to be the announcement. Now, he's historically late, but who knows? It might be actually on time this time. Who knows?
Okay. And there's a long list of folks in the running?
I think there are different... I think there are different speculations about who it could be. You know, would he pick an opponent who could run against him in 2010 for governor? Would he pick someone who, one of his friends, or would he pick himself? I mean, there's been all different sorts of guesses. And really, I think that it's just, I'd like to wait until 1:30 to find out for sure who it is. And it could be someone, it could be someone from the U.S. House, not Illinois House. I mean, it really could be, or it could be one of the constitutional officers from the state, like I said, who possibly could be one of his gubernatorial opponents in 2010.
Okay.
We just don't know yet.
2010.
Yeah.
We're talking about 2010, and here in 2008, we've, I think, to some extent, we're beginning to set the stage for 2010. Where are we headed, 2010?
Well, I think the biggest question, based on yesterday's election results, is where Republicans are heading, because they really have some rebuilding to do. They've been down for the past 2 years because the last election cycle had a Democratic wave, but this Democratic wave was even bigger. Now the House has 69 seats for sure. The House Democrats, have 69 of 118 seats for sure, and they're still waiting on one more race to gather the official results. They could have 70 members. That's only one member away from a supermajority. I mean, that's big. Republicans, if the House Democrats get a supermajority, Republicans would not have a seat at the table for major legislation.
Hmm. What will it take for the GOP to rebuild in Illinois?
They have to find a leader. They really do. I think that today we find out that the Senate Minority Leader, Frank Watson from Greenville, is no longer going to seek that position anymore. He's stepping down. He had a minor stroke last month, and he says he needs to focus on his recovery. He'll still continue to serve, but he's stepping down. So that could give the Senate Republicans at least a new leader, a new face, a new momentum. And the House, their leader is House Minority Leader Tom Cross of Oswego. He's been a leader, but at the same time, they need a statewide leader. And to this point, there really hasn't been one. Christine Redonio, her name has been bounced around before. She's from the Chicago suburbs. She is ran for treasurer in the last election, but lost to Alexi Giannoulias, who is now treasurer. She's mentioned as a potential leader. There are names floating out there, but really they just have to find the first person who really builds their priorities together and gives them the momentum that they've been lacking for the past 2 years.
Yeah. How is it that the Republican Party finds itself in this position in Illinois?
I think it's a national trend as well. It's not something that is dysfunctional about the Republican Party here. I mean, they've had some issues with George Ryan trying to rebuild after that damaged their reputation and people left a bad taste in people's mouths. I mean, that's definitely a factor. But at the same time, you know, they've had time. They've had some turnover, so it's time to get over that, and they acknowledge that. But there are national trends going on here that really, in the Chicago suburbs, that are the perfect example. People moving out of the cities and turning traditionally Republican areas into Democratic areas, or at least purple areas for now, potentially Democrat in the future. So there are some things that I think as a nation, to tell you the truth, this may be beyond my scope even, but as a nation, I think the Republicans need to redefine their platform a little bit and rebuild their credibility. And in this state, like I said, that could start with finding a person who's going to be their leader.
Mm. This is Focus 580, our guest in this first half hour of the program, Bethany Yeager, State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Issues Magazine. We're taking a look this morning, and here early in the going, we're taking a look at what happened in Illinois and what lies ahead in state politics. I'm Celeste Quinn, in today with
David Inge, the usual host of Focus 580. We thought we'd try to do something a little bit different this morning, try to get in a few more guests, and of course, as always, to invite questions and talk over the course of the program about yesterday's voting. We do have another caller, and why don't we go ahead and talk with them, and we're going to go to our toll-free line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning to you all. I wanted to bring up the question as to Mr. Obama's, President-elect Obama's, election came mainly because of the economic downturn that's happened in the last 2-3 months. Now, we here in Illinois have experienced this downturn, since the 90s. We have never, ever recovered from very many of these recessions that we've had or downturns, whatever we call it. And I think when it comes to state politics, probably the thing that most important to this state to get back into the realm of the economically positive frame, we have to change some of the rules we have in the state of Illinois. And with this election and the people who have been put into office, is that going to be possible?
Well, that actually relates to one of the ballot questions. People lost an opportunity in yesterday's election. The Constitutional Convention would have been an opportunity to change some of the rules for, say, redistricting, how the legislative map is drawn and redrawn every few years, and there would have been options for recall amendments to recall your elected officials if you don't like the job they're doing. School funding reform would have been on the table, pension funding reform, which is a huge problem in Illinois, a chronic problem extending years, not just this current administration. So I think there was an opportunity to have a constitutional convention, but that question was denied by voters yesterday. 68% voted no, 32% voted yes. And so that's not to say those things can't happen, but it is to say that one opportunity to make those things happen was lost yesterday. But there's still a possibility for constitutional amendments just through individual amendments that have to work their way through the legislature. That's still one opportunity.
Well, I'm not sure that the Constitutional Convention was really going to solve that problem as much as changes in the workman's comp and many of the rules we have here in the state of Illinois that seem to be somewhat detrimental to businesses, large businesses moving here.
Mm-hmm.
Between here and Champaign, I'm in the Belgium area, the eastern side of Illinois. Between here and Champaign, there was supposed to be a very large automotive plant that was looked into. And the reason why they went to Indiana was mainly because of the environment for businesses here. And I don't know if that was going to be addressed by the Constitutional Convention.
You could be right, but at the same time, tax reform really, I'm sorry I didn't mention that the first time. I mentioned school funding reform, which is inherent in tax reform. Tax reform really would have a lot to do with the business climate in the state, and that still could be addressed, but it would have surely been addressed in the Constitutional Convention.
Hmm. Were you surprised, Bethany, that the margin of defeat, 68% no, 32% yes?
You know, that was a pretty big percentage. I had a feeling it would not pass because there was a huge campaign to defeat the referendum, and that campaign was led with money and a coalition that a lot of business groups, a lot of teachers groups, anyone who was worried about public pensions, and people who served in the previous Constitutional Convention in 1970 were working to defeat it. They thought the Constitution that they wrote back in 1970 was able to last and grow and change. So they were all working together to defeat it, and there was a coalition to support it. But I don't, to tell you the truth, from my point of view, I don't know if they had the organization from the beginning. I don't know. They started educating people, but I don't know if it was too late or if it just didn't reach as many people or if fear of the unknown really ruled. But there's also, there actually is a legal battle going on as well over the language that mm-hmm. was included in the question. The language was, in fact, incorrect in saying that if you did not vote on that question, which was the first question on the ballot, that equated a no vote. That is factually incorrect, as ruled by a judge. And voters were supposed to get a blue piece of paper mm-hmm. telling them that that sentence is incorrect. And also the part of the question that said in 1988, the last time the question went to voters, it was rejected by an even larger margin, a 3-1 margin. That was included in the question, and the judge ruled that that should not have been. It needed to be more neutral. And so that language is in there, and this blue piece of paper was supposed to tell you, don't ignore this question, just vote on this simple yes or no. So the legal challenge to that is
still out there.
Still out there, and it actually could get worse, or come back, I should say, because some people didn't get their blue pieces of paper.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Clay County, I believe, on line one.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Gary Burt. I'm in Placer, Illinois, and I have a concern about the fact that the state of Illinois is basically broke. And it's going to take some intestinal fortitude on the part of the new electorate to address this problem. Basically, you're either going to have to cut everything to the bone, which they've done quite a bit already, or you're going to have to raise taxes. And gambling is a nice thing to play with, but the thing of it is it's not a solid revenue source. People don't have to go gamble. Is there anyone going to propose any taxes to, say, raise the state sales tax, do something about maybe taxing services or doing something like that? I mean, my wife's a retired school teacher. She depends on a pension from the mm-hmm. state, and the state is borrowing heavily from the teacher's retirement fund. What solutions are being put out there, and are there any new ideas by the new politicians coming into office that yeah. might have a chance of actually solving the state's financial crisis?
Well, you gave a really good summary, and to tell you the truth, those proposals have been out there. They've been introduced. They usually advance, get some attention, and then they deflate. And you're exactly right in saying that the political fortitude is just not there. They're tough votes. They're votes that would be used against the legislators in their next elections to say, well, he voted or she voted to raise your taxes. So I think the ideas are there. They've been around. It really just takes a new momentum and a new realization that the state will flounder, continue to flounder, because we're already in trouble if they don't make some changes. As far as who could bring those changes to the table, there has been speculation that House Speaker Michael Madigan, who holds a lot of power in the legislature, could propose or support a tax increase in the future. He said he would not do it this year, this fall, but that doesn't mean he wouldn't do it in the future. And he's been on the record before saying, you know, there are going to have to be tough votes. It's going to involve some pain to get out of this. And by that,
it really, you can kind of assume that he means taxes. So I think there's a possibility it could come up. I don't know if it'll come up this next year or the year after. I guess the timing has to be right. And the governor has repeatedly said he would veto any tax increases in sales tax or income taxes, general state taxes. And so that's been a deterrent as well. And so maybe it might not happen until a new governor comes along, because if the General Assembly, even if the General Assembly passed a tax increase of some sort, it would be vetoed by the governor. And then it's up to the legislature to override his veto, which is a tough challenge.
Yeah. Thanks for the call this afternoon. David, what do you say we take another call? Who's next in line?
Champagne. It's line number two right
okay.
here. Hello.
Hi. I'm going to ask about the Fitzgerald, indictments that he's bringing, and how you see that playing out further, if you have any thoughts about it. Obviously, the first question has to do with whether the governor is going to get indicted, and who else is, what other dominoes are waiting to fall. We've just had another guilty plea, and therefore probably are going to have more, cooperation.
Patrick question. Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney. Bethany?
Yeah, the attorney just released another indictment that is pretty significant. It's of a Republican, actually, in Sangamon County, actually in Springfield, who's been a huge player, not just in the Blagojevich administration, but in previous administrations for going back, I think, almost four administrations. He's been a significant player in politics in Springfield. He was just indicted, and he actually has had relations with Tony Rudzko, and I think people by now recognize that name as a Blagojevich insider who was not actually a hired employee, but was a political insider, an advisor, and a fundraiser. And anyone tied to Tony Rudzko really is vulnerable at this point to indictments, including Bill Cellini, who, like I said, was just indicted. But he is fighting that indictment, saying he did nothing wrong, and that this evidence that the U.S. attorney gathered is not credible. There are more indictments to come, at least a few more. Many, many people are involved in this this investigation, and there are multiple investigations, as I should mention. It's not just one. Will the governor be indicted? I don't have a crystal ball. Mm-hmm. Many people are saying it's all pointing towards, if you read the indictments, they really are pointing towards, they are mentioning public official A, which has already been identified as Governor Rod Blagojevich. When it will happen, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball again. But at the same time, there's no telling if it could be a few months, a year. We don't know. And the word, what's the word? I'm drawing a blank for the word. Impeaching the governor, that has been mentioned in the legislature as a possibility. People are already doing their homework about how to do that and what it would take. And if any indictment of the governor came down, I would just anticipate seeing an impeachment process started. I don't know if immediately, but soon. So it's always out there. It's always kind of a wait and see, a hurry up and wait, I guess, if you will. It really does affect the atmosphere in the Capitol, but I guess the legislature has to keep plugging away, not knowing when those indictments will come.
Yeah, we've seen over the last several years now so many scandals, indictments, trials.
It's scandal fatigue. It really is. I think voters are sick of it.
Yeah, but you wonder who are going to be the leaders to emerge, and I would think that people are going to really start to really demand. Who knows? I don't know. This is Illinois, but clean government. What are the chances? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think one positive point is the ethics reform that the legislature and the did just approve and enact, despite the governor's vetoes to change it. It bans contributions, campaign contributions, from state contractors who are holding significant state contracts, big money here. They can no longer donate to the governor or the executive officers. I mean, that's a really big deal. It's significant. It's only a baby step, though, but it is significant. That's one step. Another step would be, and the governor, I guess, he did technically propose expanding that same contribution ban to all state legislators, as well as statewide political parties, meaning the Illinois Democratic Party, the Illinois Republican Party. That would be another step that would be huge, but I don't know
if they're ready to go that far. The legislature acts pretty slowly on those types of issues.
And there we're going to wrap up this portion of Focus 580. And our thanks this afternoon to, or excuse me, this morning. I'm in this morning. I'll also be here this afternoon. Our thanks to Bethany Yeager, a State House Bureau Chief for Illinois Issues Magazine. She also writes a blog called Illinois Issues Blog. Bethany, thank you so much.
This is Focus 580, and I'm David Inge, the customary host of the program. Also joining me this morning in the studio to share in the hosting, Celeste Quinn. And we thought we'd take this very first opportunity here after yesterday's election to try to talk a little bit about what happened, about what it means for politics here in the state of Illinois, about what it means for politics nationally. And we're doing something a little bit different, so we've split up the hours so that instead of the usual one guest 1 hour, we have two in each, and we ask them to you spend half an hour with
and
us.
And coming up, two political scientists,
back
the first
back.
Of which is going
which,
to be joining us here in just
yes,
a moment.
As soon as we get him lined up. And so also I want to make sure that people who are listening know that we're continuing to invite questions as always. The same numbers that we always usually use, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. Just the only thing we're asking people is, particularly today, because we're running kind of tight, if people try to keep their questions and comments brief, but we certainly welcome them.
We're talking about the campaign, the election, what lies ahead. Coming up, two political scientists, one at a time, and then our final guest this morning will be an economist, a professor of economics at the University of Illinois. David Inge, I think we have our next guest ready
yes,
to
indeed.
Go.
In this now second part of the hour, we'll be talking with Scott McClurg. He is an associate professor of political science at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He teaches American politics there. He's particularly interested in things like political participation, electoral behavior, political geography, campaign dynamics, and we're very pleased to have him with us. And of course, throughout the rest of this half hour, we'd be happy to have questions and comments from people who are listening. Professor McClurg, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well, good. Thanks. And yourself?
Very good, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. Aside from the obvious historic features of the election yesterday, will we look back on this election and say that in some important ways the political landscape of the country changed?
You know, I think that's a great question, and unfortunately it's not real clear at this point in time. You know, I think the tendency, the temptation is to say yes, because it is a historic moment in a lot of ways. On the other hand, there's, you know, pretty good reason to believe that this is politics as usual, in the sense that the usual things that predict election outcomes, like the economy, the popularity of the president, were all favoring Democrats pretty strongly this time around. And I think that muddies the waters quite a bit and, you know, makes me, at least at this point, say I'm not so sure that we've really seen a significant change in the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, there were a lot of people clearly very excited about participating, and this seems to fly in the face of the kinds of things we'd said so long about people being disenchanted with American politics. We know that people look forward to voting. A lot of people voted early. A lot of people stood in line for a long period of time to vote. Do you think that kind of turnout is something that is temporary? Does that just say something about where we are now? Or would that encourage you if you think that greater participation is a good thing?
Well, I think that the signs here are actually a little bit more encouraging for a long-term shift in things. In the wake of the 2000 election, we've seen pretty consistently turnout has been going up, and we've also seen the states and the federal government take actions towards making voting a lot easier. And as a consequence, I think that we've seen an increase in voting, not as large as maybe people might think, but it's been a consistent trend towards more and more people voting. And I think the signs are positive that at least for the next few elections that this is going to continue.
This, I think we saw here people in unprecedented numbers taking the option of early voting. That I think that some people say we need to do something about the way that we vote to make it perhaps easier. Perhaps it shouldn't be on a weekday. It shouldn't be on a work day. Is this something, do you think, that will carry forward now? It might lead us to think differently about the voting mechanism. Or again, does that just say something about right where we are right now and perhaps the enthusiasm of a lot of people for voting for Mr. Obama.
Well, I think we're actually moving towards, again, I think we see a structural shift here in the sense that I think we're going to see continued discussion about the right kinds of balloting mechanisms, whether we should use paper ballots or computerized ballots. There seems to be a lot of interest among politicians and interest groups and think tanks and academics behind that question. And I also think that the same thing is true for early voting and voting by mail and some of the alternatives that we've seen crop up and be used more frequently. Even in places like Illinois, early voting was being used pretty strongly, even though, for the most part, the state didn't really have a lot of controversial or highly contested elections. Hmm. And I think that speaks pretty highly of seeing more and more of this in the future. Although we still haven't really started talking about elections as a national holiday, as we see in some European nations, unfortunately.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on how the campaigns engaged voters?
Well, I think that the one thing that really stands out to me in this particular election cycle is that we saw a big step forward in the use of technology for reaching out to voters. I heard a commentator last night say that this is the first 21st century election we've had, and my observation suggests that that's probably the case. The Republicans have for some time now had a pretty good get-out-the-vote operation, and the Obama folks, in part because of their significant fundraising this time around, were able to really bring the Democrats into the 21st century as well. And so we saw the candidates reaching out to voters in terms of issues in ways that they haven't before, with micro-targeting and very sophisticated targeting of issues towards voters, but also just finding them in contacting them in ways that they haven't before through Facebook and MySpace and similar sorts of outlets.
And also in terms of raising money.
Oh, absolutely. And again, the Obama campaign really took what Howard Dean had done in 2004 and took it a whole other step to raise all kinds of small contributions. And that was really the secret of his longevity in the face of, you know, what looked like a pretty insurmountable Clinton campaign during the primaries.
Well, just real quick, and I want to promise I have a caller here I want to get to. I just want to ask one further question about money, because I think that a lot of people initially criticized Mr. Obama's decision to forego federal financing. Of course, that made it possible for him to raise an enormous amount of money. And some people are now saying, right out there saying, federal financing of presidential campaigns is now dead. No one is going to take that option again in the future when they've seen how much money Obama can raise. And some people have also said, well, maybe that doesn't matter. Do you think, one, that it is federal financing is dead, and two, does that matter?
Well, sort of, and yes. I think that what we'll see with federal financing, it was already sort of dead anyway in some respects. And this is true in two ways. First of all, we've seen serious candidates in the primaries forego federal funding there because they didn't want to have their hands tied. And it's really sort of the also-rans, the folks running for other reasons that have taken advantage of that. And the other reason it's sort of been dead is that, you know, first through soft money and then through 527 funds, there have always sort of been ways around that. I think with the death of soft money, which is basically money that goes to the parties that still got spent on presidential campaigns, I think candidates, since they don't really trust the 527s, are going to be much more likely to forego the federal campaign system. So it's not entirely dead. We're still going to see, particularly in the primaries, candidates opting into the system. With regards to, is this a good thing? Right, that was the second question?
Yeah, that's right.
In some ways, I do think it's a good thing. You know, Americans tend to look at money as sort of a bad thing in politics. I'm not always sure that's the case. It does mean, especially in the case of the Obama campaign, that they were really able to expand their campaign into a much larger number of states than we've seen candidates and campaigns go into the past. And there's one real problem with our presidential election system right now, in my opinion. It's that it's really an intense contested campaign in about 10 states. And I think anything that encourages them to communicate with more voters across a wider variety of states, to do more organizing and get more people engaged is a good thing.
Right. We have about 15 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580. We're doing something different this morning. We've split up the hours. We have four guests instead of two, and here in studio with me to help out with hosting is Celeste Quinn. But as always, we're looking for callers. And we have somebody who's been patient with us here, and they're calling from St. Charles, and we'll talk with them. They're on the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Great topic. I'm glad. All I can say is I'm glad it's over with. It's a long 2 years, I would think. Yeah, you know, I have a friend of mine, actually, that ran for Green Party up in South Elgin. And, you know, he had a hard time trying to get the funds together. Now, you know, I'd be wishy-washy on this, trying to find a fine line, but, you know, spending money for campaigning. It's kind of hard when you're a small guy trying to put on a campaign. When you got, you know, bigger guys like Jim Oberweis or somebody else like that, or Bill Foster, that gets funds from, you know, corporate sponsors. And that's the only downfall I see with the negative, I would say, on maybe buying what I say would say a campaign. You know, I think that's what Barack Obama had was, I actually think he bought the campaign because of his candidacy.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned Jim Oberweis because now he's been unsuccessful once again. So let's go back to Scott McClurg.
Well, I have a couple of reactions. You know, I think the caller had a really good point when he said that, you know, the real struggle here is for, you know, the Green Party kinds of candidates. And, you know, people see the kind of money Democrats and Republicans can raise, and they get troubled by that, and they say that it contributes to our two-party system. And I think they're right about that. But I think what folks also tend to forget that is if we make it easier for the Green Party to raise money, it also makes it easier for some small parties that are maybe a little more offensive to American tastes, fascists, and these folks are out there. To also get public funding and things of that nature. And so there's a trade-off there that hasn't ever really been a part of the discussion. If you wanted to make, really regulate campaign contributions and open it up to lots more parties, well, where do you draw the line about which parties can and can't get money? I think the other reaction I have here is to the idea that Obama bought the election. I think this is going to be a popular interpretation in the media in the next couple of weeks. You know, but at the end of the day, I think what we want to keep in mind is if the Obama campaign had to choose between a 2-to-1 fundraising advantage or a bad economy and an unpopular president, they would choose the bad economy and the unpopular president and give up their fundraising advantage. And ultimately, that's really what this election was about.
Well, I want to thank the caller again. I hope he won't mind because we've got some other folks. Just a quick point to reinforce, though. I think that a lot of people would say that, yes, it's true the Obama campaign raised a lot of money, but that a lot of that money was raised through the internet, and it was small contributions from individuals. It wasn't high rollers giving what the maximum allowed would be.
No, that's absolutely right. You know, Obama is not Hillary Clinton. You know, Hillary Clinton and before her husband, they were really good at working the interest groups, the large contributions, the Washington insider fundraising circuit. You know, while certainly some of that money went to the Obama campaign this cycle around, really what the secret of their fundraising advantage success was the ability to get $5, $10, $15 contributions from regular American voters. You know, I think probably most people are not so troubled about Joe Plummer giving a $5 or $10 contribution than they are, you know, a corporation funneling $200,000 or $300,000 to a campaign.
All right. We have another caller, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
It was very impressive to see, you know, just as you were saying, how many people got involved, how many people felt that they had a stake in this campaign, both in giving money and in contributing time and so forth. So this vast organization has been set up. Is there any hope that you see of people remaining involved, not just to elect a candidate, but to speak to their government to in an organized way? Are we going to lose all the people power that's been assembled now that the election is over?
Very interesting question.
Yeah. Well, that's a fantastic question. You know, my the cynic in me, which is based on reading a lot of political science, unfortunately, says that we are going to lose a big chunk of this enthusiasm. However, you know, there's a part of me that says, after listening to both of the candidates' speeches last night, that both of them want to find ways to sort of keep people involved. And I hope that that's not just rhetoric. I hope that, you know, we do see the government reaching out to young people in terms of service, in terms of middle-aged voters and middle-class voters, in terms of getting their input and building support behind tackling some of the tough problems. But right now, it's just not clear exactly how they would do that. And the temptation for average people is to go back to their daily lives and the things that do concern them, the children's soccer game, you know, finding a better job, paying their bills, and to sort of not worry about the politics again until the next election rolls around. Thanks.
Well, thank you. And other questions are welcome here. We have about maybe about 10 minutes in this first hour. Focus 580-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Scott McClurg. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Southern Illinois University Carbondale this morning on the show. Both hours, we're trying to talk about some of the issues that the next president will face and some of the interesting things that happened yesterday when people went to the polls. And we are dividing things up so that we have in each hour, we have two guests. And I'm David Inge, and Celeste Quinn is here with me as well.
And in this portion of the program, we have Scott McClurg, yeah, Associate Professor of Political Science at Southern Illinois University.
You know, one of the things that I was wondering, Scott, it was very clear here that Mr. Obama got a lot of support from African Americans, from Latinos, and generally from people under 30. African Americans have for a while now been perhaps the most reliable supporters of the Democratic Party. There were some questions about Latinos and what they would do. Now, though, I wonder if now can the Democrats now come to rely on this now, say, enlarged base of support that particularly involves African Americans, Latinos, and young people. I guess the question is, can the Democrats hold on to this block as they get older and they continue to be involved and continue to go to the polls?
Yeah, I think this is a pretty good question for a lot of reasons. I was of the opinion probably about 3 or 4 years ago that with the rise of the African American middle class, the Democrats, if they didn't start thinking seriously about the black vote, were in danger of starting to lose it as a very key part of their coalition. I think that the sheer symbolism of this probably goes a long way to stemming that potential loss of black votes, at least for, you know, a couple of electoral cycles. I think the group here that's really most questionable as being part of a fundamental Democratic coalition is the Latino vote. You know, as I'm sure most of your listeners and you know, Obama did quite a bit better among Hispanic voters than previous Democrats had done. George Bush got something like 40% of the Latino vote nationwide, and this time around it's only about 15% for John McCain, maybe a little bit higher than that. But this is a tougher group for Democrats to hold on to for a variety of reasons. One, it's not, you know, not all Latino voters are the same. There are pretty significant differences among Cubans and Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and folks from other parts of South America and Central America. And some of these voters are socially fairly conservative. They're very Catholic. I think that for the Democrats to really solidify this, they really have to take some of their economic message and really put it into policy and really make it work, which really does mean spreading the wealth at some level and really tackling the issue of immigration. It's not clear to me that the political will is going to be there to do some of these things just yet, but I think that's the key.
Do you think Senator McCain had some difficulty here because his message seemed to drift and shift, and so maybe the folks that he might have pulled along fell away?
Yeah, I think that was part of John McCain's problem. You know, the big advantage, if we you know, go back 6 months and we would have been talking about this potential matchup. I think the big advantage that John McCain had was that he was seen to be by the typical American public as being a maverick, but the real challenge he had was mobilizing the Republican base, and in particular the conservatives in the party. And he never really reconciled what his message was going to be that would embrace that maverick role that he has while also mobilizing and galvanizing the base. And I think that we saw that throughout the campaign. He could never really pinpoint his message. And I think at the end of the day, that really he just never really overcame that challenge. Now, I think it was a pretty, you know, uphill battle that he was facing either way, but he didn't do himself any favors either.
What about his choice of Sarah Palin?
You know, I go against the grain on this one a little bit. I actually end up thinking that choice helped him more than it hurt him, because it did go a long way to solidifying the base. She did seem to be pretty popular among religious conservatives and part of the libertarian part of the Republican Party. You know, the libertarian on the economic questions. And I think she helped him there. I don't know how many independent voters at the end of the day really left John McCain because of that. I think it's more likely that they deserted him on issues of, you know, like the economy and approval of George Bush and McCain's record of voting with the president.
I hope it, you know, people will forgive a question about polling because people think we talk too much about that. But there are a lot of polls, and now we have websites where they take multiple polls and try to average them together to smooth out the differences to get an aggregate kind of result. And in leading up to the voting, I think that there are a lot of people, or people in the political science business at least, were, and in the polling business, were kind of nervous because the polls were very consistent showing Mr. Obama with a lead, and that held at least for the past couple of weeks, and yet in the past polls have turned out to be very wrong. So this time around the polls got it right, and now does that reflect some kind of change in our ability to actually do polling and get good accurate information?
Yes, I do think that that's the case, and in particular, you know, I think while a lot of people are very dissatisfied with the proliferation of polls, I mean, it seems like everybody's doing a poll these days. A political scientist, by contrast, were very excited because what that means is we've got a lot more data points, and you can, you know, anytime you do a single survey, you know, you run a chance that you get a weird group of people. It's what you know, survey folks call measurement error and survey error. And when you can average over a whole bunch of polls, it gets rid of all that error. It cancels out, and we get a lot better sense of what's going on. And so I think the proliferation of the polls has really helped sort of folks like Charles Franklin at pollster.com and Real Clear Politics in the sense that they really do get these much better estimates. On top of that, however, I think that the polling industry has learned a lot from the last two election cycles in particular about how to estimate likely voters, about how to couch their methodologies a little bit and be a little bit smarter about things, how to deal with the internet and how to deal with cell phone only citizens and things like that.
Should we take another call? We're running down on time, so let's take another call before we get too far out here.
Right.
Listener in Chicago, I believe, line 4. Good morning.
Thank you. I'd like to reiterate something that the former press secretary, President Johnson, said. He felt that the job of the president is more than one person can handle. And today we see conditions that overwhelm the capacity of hardly anyone, let alone all their advisors, to deal with. So I think while we talk about the president and administration and so forth, there has to be thoughts on restructuring the whole process to some extent, because Republican or Democrat, they both have to realize there's so many issues they all would have to attend to, and the degree of separation and bringing things to a standstill because of gridlock and so forth. So I think all these things have to be considered because of that, and let alone other factors. But we're short on time, so I thought I'd let you hear that anyway.
Sure. And when we have maybe about a minute or so left, I don't know, you want to reflect, Professor McClurg, on the difficulty of the challenge that confronts the next president?
Yeah. You know, and the caller's absolutely right in that these are not problems that one person can solve. And I think that President-elect Obama really sort of embraced that idea last night that it wasn't his job alone to fix all these problems, that all the people who had been working for both campaigns were going to have to roll up their sleeves and get to work. For the president-elect, this starts with thinking seriously about the transition and really hitting the ground running and thinking about what kind of administration he wants to have. But more than anything, I think that Barack Obama last night, in the middle of the speech, it almost seemed like he realized how high he had really raised expectations for people and just how significant the challenge is that he's facing. And so I think the next couple of weeks are going to tell us a lot about how he's going to tackle that and to what extent he's going to really reach across party lines in order to try and make progress on some of the great issues of our day.
All right, there. We're going to have to leave it with our thanks to Scott McClurg. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Professor McClurg, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're coming down here to the end of the first hour of Focus 580. We're doing something unusual, something that we've not done before here. I'm David Inge. Celeste Quinn is with me, host of the Afternoon Magazine. We thought we'd host together and have a little bit more variety in terms of guests, having two in each hour. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, Celeste will talk with another political scientist, and I'm also going to talk with an economist.
That's correct. David Lewis will join us following news from National Public Radio. He's a political scientist at Vanderbilt University, and we'll try and focus with him on, you know, what's ahead in the immediate future, that, you know, the first 100 days, mm-hmm. that kind of an idea. And then following our conversation with Professor Lewis, we will talk with an economist from the University of Illinois.
Ann Villamil. And certainly we decided we wanted to try to do that, to focus on one segment on the economy, simply because that seems to be the big issue that was on everyone's mind.
So we hope you'll stay tuned, and our thanks this afternoon, or excuse me, I'm in afternoon mode. I host the Afternoon Magazine. Our thanks this morning to producers Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal for putting this program together, helping us put it together.